So, thank you. So, I'm Tremel Hudson, and I'm going to be talking about ThunderStrike 2, which is a firmware vulnerability, or a set of firmware vulnerabilities on MacBooks. You might have seen it in the press as, you know, the first firmware worm that affects Macs, that it's, you know, super stealthy and backdoors them, that it remains after reformatting and can be remotely installed, and that it's undetectable and it can't be removed. There's a lot of hyperbole in these sort of press reports, but it is true that firmware malware, once it's installed, is very hard to detect, very hard to remove. And that's because it installs in the SPI flash on the motherboard, also called the boot ROM. And on most systems, the SPI flash is really the root of trust. This is where all of everything in so the security of the boot process depends on the sanctity of the boot flash. And because this boot flash contains literally the first instruction the CPU executes when it starts up, it's possible to circumvent any other software mechanism that attempts to ensure security. So, one other really important part about this talk is that ThunderStrike 2 is not a new vulnerability. It's actually built on five previously disclosed multi-year-old UEFI firmware vulnerabilities that, along with collaborators Corey Kallenberg and Zeno Kova, we were able to port from commodity PCs to Mac systems. And that is the real key point of this talk, is that UEFI firmware vulnerabilities are shared between these different systems because they share so much in common. You might think that your shiny MacBook has nothing in common with some run-of-the-mill commodity desktop PC. It has a different motherboard, it has a different OS, it runs, you know, pretty much everything is different, but under the covers, they look very, very similar. That when you disassemble it, we see the same sort of code paths. We see the same functions being called. We see the same vulnerabilities appearing, even though they're built with different compilers, different optimization, and frequently very different versions. There's still a lot of commonality. And the commonality goes back to the earliest days of the PC. IBM's 16-bit real mode BIOS in the early 80s was cloned by Phoenix, and then everyone else reverse engineered and cloned that one. In 95, Intel started the Extensible Firmware Interface Project to try to support new CPUs, bigger memory, fancier hard drives and things. And in the early 2000s, when Apple switched over to the Intel CPUs, they forked Intel's EFI standard and used that for their systems. A few years later, Intel transferred all ownership of EFI to the Unified EFI Forum, and that's why it's called UEFI now. And the forum has continued development, adding a lot of features, secure boot, and other things. And they continue development on this. We can see that on Christmas Day, there were commits being made to their code tree. And some of these are security related. You know, a suspicious null pointer dereference could be a security vulnerability. So even after 10 years or so of divergence, there's still millions of lines of code shared between Apple's EFI and the more recent UEFI firmware. What most firmware vendors do is very similar to what Apple has done. They fork the open source tree at whatever version it is. They kind of freeze at that head. They port it to hardware platforms, and they sell these packaged firmwares. So when Intel fixes, or excuse me, when the EFI forum fixes bugs in the EDK2 tree, that doesn't mean that all the vendors have actually done a Git pull and patched. And even if they have fixed it on their new motherboards, they haven't necessarily fixed it on their decades of legacy systems. And even if they've shipped a firmware update, there's no guarantee that users install it. Most people don't install firmware. And this is an area where Apple has actually really excelled. that they are actively pushing firmware updates for systems going back almost 10 years when firmware security vulnerabilities are disclosed to them. So that's enough of the history lesson. Let's talk a little more about ThunderStrike 2. As I mentioned, it's built on 5 previously disclosed multi-year-old firmware vulnerabilities. These have been, all the details have been published going back 2014, 2013, some of them as early as 2007. This first one, the Speed Racer, was presented last year here at 31C3 by Corey Kallenberg. And it is a hardware race condition that allows in a multi-core CPU, allows a second core to get write access to the BIOS. And the reason for this goes back to, again, legacy hardware. The Intel interface control hub was designed for a single-threaded system. There's the BIOS write enable bit that prevents accidental writes to the firmware unless you're in ring zero. There's the BIOS lock enable bit that allows SMM to arbitrate writes, the BIOS write enable bit. When the write enable bit is set to 1, an SMI is generated, SMM gets a chance to decide whether to allow it, and if it doesn't want to allow it, it sets the bit back to 0. But that leaves a race condition where the second thread has BIOS write enabled turned on for a few cycles, and it can keep trying to write to it. Intel actually realized this was a problem in 2004 when they migrated to the platform controller hub, and they added a third protection bit, the SMM BIOS write protect disable, in which all threads have to be in SMM in order to be able to write to the firmware. So on a correctly configured system, the write access to the firmware is controlled first by the protected range registers, and then by the SMM BWP bit, and then by the BIOS lock enable bit. Corey and his collaborators went through responsible disclosure and disclosed all the details to CERT, and most of the firmware vendors were affected because they had not updated to use all of these hardware protection measures that Intel was providing. Apple specifically said, however, that they were not affected. So we wanted to find out if that was actually the case. Going back to the data sheet, we can read the BIOS control register, which is at offset DC in the hub. And we can use a tool like Read Memory, which is a open source tool that lets you read arbitrary physical memory on OS X. And what we find is that it has the value of 8. And that means that neither the BIOS write protect bit nor the BIOS lock enable bit are set. This is not the recommended configuration, and it turns out that a OS resident attacker is able to write a 1 to the BIOS write enable bit, and now they can write to the BIOS. They can't write to the entire BIOS because of the protected range registers, but it does mean that they can write arbitrarily into the NVRAM variables. They can also write to any region that's not protected by the protected range registers. And if you corrupt that portion of the firmware, it actually bricks the machine so that it is unable to boot. We went through, again, disclosure with Apple, and they rolled out a fix. And it goes all the way back to 10.6.8, which was released in 2008. So that's almost 8 years of systems that are now protected. And because Apple does the automatic rollout, these systems, for the most part, have been updated and are now protected. One problem is that the fix was just by changing the protected range register, which means that the SMM BIOS write protect is still not set, and the BIOS write enable bit is still vulnerable to an OS resident attacker. So only the protected range registers are preventing writes. Which brings us to our second vulnerability. The Darth Venomous, or Dark Jedi Coma attack, also presented publicly for the first time last year at CCC by Rafal and some collaborators. What they realized is that when the system goes into a S3 suspend to RAM sleep, all of the flash protection bits get unlocked. And when the system comes out of sleep, there's a brief race window that allows an attacker to have write access to the firmware. As always, they went through responsible disclosure. And it turns out that Apple was not contacted by CERT regarding this, but they were informed through USRT. To understand how to take advantage of this vulnerability, we have to go back to the bootscript specification, which describes how the system, how EFI goes through a normal boot and then when it resumes. During a normal boot, the system probes for connected devices, looks to see what's out there, and it writes a sort of a cheat sheet of memory addresses and configuration registers into this boot script. And then on a resume, it just runs through the script right into those same addresses. Not everything can be expressed in just a simple write, so there's a dispatch opcode that gives you the ability to put in a function pointer. So again, we can use the read memory tool to read out the boot script, which is actually the pointer to it is stored in a NVRAM variable. And when we parse it, we see a bunch of those memory writes. And this write down here is the one that writes into the protected range registers and the flock down bit to lock them. But that occurs too late in the boot script. We've already had a dispatch to a function. And because the boot script lives in unprotected memory, we can use the writemem tool to poke our own function pointer in there. And then when the system goes into sleep, which is a user command, the system wakes back up, and those protected range registers are no longer protected, which allows the OS resident attacker to write pretty much anywhere in the firmware for the CPU, which again allows it to take control of the machine from that first instruction and circumvent any other chain of trust. We again went through responsible disclosure with Apple, and they in their notes said that an insufficient locking issue existed, and it was addressed through improved locking. So very brief commit log there. There's an additional sleep vulnerability that we didn't see, but was also fixed in that patch. OS X Reverser also watched the CCC talk last year and experimented on recreating it on his MacBook. What he found was actually much worse, that the S3 implementation left the flash protection completely unlocked after a suspend resume cycle. As you might imagine, that's a bad thing. And it turns out this is a rediscovery of a 2013 vulnerability called Snorlax, in which Dell systems failed to properly set write protection after resuming from sleep. And that was a team at MITRE that found that. The reason that we didn't see it in our tests is that our slightly newer MacBooks had a different Intel chipset. And at some point, there had been a silent fix that either Intel rolled out an improved reference implementation for that hardware or Apple fixed it. But it meant that new machines were not vulnerable to this issue, but older machines were. And no one publicly knew which were which. There's a similar silent fix that happened with the brand new MacBooks, the ones with the USB-C only, that it appears to be using something like SMM lockbox, so they're not vulnerable to the bootscript hijacking. So as I mentioned, Apple addressed both the Darth Venomous and the Snorlax or Prince Harmon vulnerabilities through improved locking. What they did is moved the code that sets the lock bits and the protected range registers to before the S3 script is executed. But the S3 script is still in unprotected memory and available for an OS resident attacker to hijack. They can't use it to directly turn off the flash protection, but there are other interesting things that this lets you do prior to the OS kernel starting up, possibly get into SMM. I'm still looking into that. So, with the easy routes to getting the flash unlocked sort of taken care of, there's one time when the flash is deliberately unlocked, and that's during a firmware update. So Corey Kallenberg found a class of integer overflow bugs that he was able to write a scanner for that searched through lots of different firmwares. And he found that a lot of these vulnerabilities occurred when the flash was in an entirely unlocked state, meaning during a firmware update. One of the machines that he showed this on was a HP laptop, and what's happening is that the length there in the descriptor buffer is user-controlled, so it's possible to generate an integer overflow in that length, which then gives him code execution, while it is parsing a firmware update. So this is being run with the flash unlocked and gives him full write access. This affected so many systems that he won the Pony Award for best privilege escalation at Black Hat earlier this year. As always, responsible disclosure is really important. And as you see, almost everyone's affected, except Apple. Apple claimed that because they don't use the standard UEFI firmware update routine, they're not vulnerable to this attack because they have their own firmware update routine. If you're interested in that, the ThunderStrike 1 talk that I gave last year at CCC goes into extensive detail about how Apple does their firmware updates. The problem comes that everything in UEFI is done via function pointers and these 128-bit GUIDs. So when you want to call a function, you pass in this GUID, and it looks it up in a table, and then returns a function pointer to you, which means that the linker can't remove a lot of dead code because there's a reference to it in this dispatch table. So the vulnerable firmware capsule update routine turns out is present in Apple's ROM. So even though Apple doesn't use this for their firmware updates, the code is still there. And through what Corey and Zeno called BIOS necromancy, they were able to generate a set of inputs that caused that code to get executed. So, again, two very different laptops, but they share very similar code in that vulnerable routine. Obviously, they've been built with different compilers and different optimization levels, but you can see that that integer overflow is still there. As a result of our work in proving that and disclosing it to Apple, they have updated their status with cert, and now a year after it was publicly announced, they've admitted that they are affected, and they have rolled out a fix. The particular vulnerability is actually kind of a very neat one to look into, that unused functions can contain these vulnerabilities. Legacy functions can contain these vulnerabilities. And it becomes really important that when code is being audited, that both the new code and this legacy code gets reviewed and gets updated. So going back to another legacy feature, one that goes back again to the 1980s with the original IBM PC, the BIOS at that time would look on the motherboard to these expansion ROM sockets to see if any optional features were installed, things like the basic interpreter, a hard drive controller. It would also look on the expansion bus to see if any cards were installed, like a video card, so that it's able to display the boot messages as the BIOS starts up. Unfortunately, this code is run in the BIOS in ring zero before the kernel, and that's really a bad idea for security. John Heisman in 2007 showed how this could be used to get persistence on servers with certain network cards. Snare in 2012 showed how Thunderbolt is actually PCIe and it loads option ROMs off PCIe. My talk at last year at CCC showed how you could use an option ROM to during a firmware update to get code execution with the unlocked ROM. And then earlier this year, Zeno and I presented a class of vulnerabilities at DEF CON related to all of these five that have been fixed. Following the disclosure at CCC, Apple rolled out a fix that partially addressed the ThunderStrike 1 issue. What they changed is that the system no longer loads option ROMs during firmware updates, which prevents ThunderStrike from getting code execution during a firmware update, but it still gives you a way to get persistence and code running on the system. There was a follow-on update a little bit later due to a rollback vulnerability. And even with this patch applied, as I mentioned, you get code execution during the boot. So if you have a Thunderbolt adapter, these Thunderbolt Ethernet adapters are super popular for this sort of research. It runs before the kernel starts, and it's able to log keystrokes, such as the firmware and file vault password there. It also gives you a way to get persistence. So if you get a remote shell on a system, you can map all of physical memory, look for PCIe devices, write your code into the option ROM on it, and the next time the system boots, that code's going to run. This is almost as good persistence as the SPI flash. It doesn't necessarily give you the ability to circumvent all of the root of trust because option ROMs are loaded much later in the boot process, but it still is a very dangerous thing to let happen. Earlier today, Johanna Vitalska presented something showing how much writable state there is in the system. And it's really scary how many things have writable firmware blobs. You know, your fancy Thunderbolt monitor has an option ROM in it. Your SSD might have an option ROM in it. So Intel realized this was a huge problem. And for the secure boot process, they require that option ROMs be signed. Unfortunately, Apple has not updated to a version of UEFI that supports secure boot, so this is not an option on Apple systems. It's also not an option if your system doesn't support secure boot. And if someone gets the ability to write to the firmware flash on the motherboard, secure boot won't do anything for you. So, but the key point is these are all cross-platform vulnerabilities that were found on commodity PCs, and we were able to port over to the Mac platform. You know, most of them are patched at this point by Apple. I've heard that the new iMacs and some of the newer systems are no longer loading option ROMs, which I think is great. And USB-C doesn't have option ROMs yet. But maybe Thunderbolt 3 will bring option ROMs to USB-C. We'll see. So, you know, all these vulnerabilities are—they're interesting. I'm glad we've got them fixed. But it was really fun to package them together into a proof of concept demo. So let's see how could this all come together. So unlike last year, it actually can start with a just a like a software exploit, maybe a software download or a Adobe Flash sandbox escape or something, that then can escalate to root with whatever the root exploit of the day is. And once it has root, it can install a kernel module to let it go walk through physical memory. If the system is subject to Prince Harman, it's able to immediately write malware into the motherboard boot flash. It can also then search the PCIe space for devices with option ROMs and write itself into them. And in this case, it found a Thunderbolt Ethernet adapter, so I'll go ahead and flag that that one's infected. And now, the next time the system reboots, the ThunderStrike 2 proof of concept is going to be run from the motherboard boot flash. It's not trying to be stealthy or anything like that, so it displays a big splash screen and logo. And because this runs before the OS X kernel has started, it can do pretty much arbitrary things. It can get into SMM, it can hide in virtualization. It has total control of the system at this point. If you reinstall OS X, it's still there. You swap out the hard drive, it's still there. Because it's literally in the motherboard. So, if we put the infected system aside and plug that infected adapter into a clean system, when this one boots, it loads the option ROM off the Thunderbolt adapter. This is a newer laptop that is not subject to Prince Harman, so it can't directly write to the flash, but it can use Darth Venomous to hook the S3 boot script, and I don't know if you can see it also reports my firmware password on there. And then the system continues to boot normally. When the system goes into an S3 sleep, such as when the lid is closed, the CPUs are going to shut down. And you don't have to open the machine. I've just done that to show that the fans have turned off, the CPUs are completely powered down. When the system wakes back up, the S3 script is executed prior to the boot flash being locked, so it's able to write itself into the boot flash on the motherboard. And again, I just flag it so I know which ones I've infected for cleanup afterwards. So from the perspective of the user of the system, it took just a couple extra seconds for it to come out of that sleep mode, but nothing out of the ordinary. So and then the next time this system reboots, it's going to also display the boot screen logo. So we've now possibly infected another machine via this sort of viral transmission. And what's interesting is this didn't touch the OS at all. This was completely at a level below the operating system. One of the other things that ThunderStrike 2 proof of concept does is it watches for the PCIe hot plug event. So when a clean adapter is plugged in, it detects that, and the interrupt handler writes the option ROM to the device. So this allows it to potentially spread and potentially cross air gap security measures. And so if you have a uranium centrifuge plant that you're trying to get into, this might be one of those ways to do it. So the proof of concept is showing a really neat sort of life cycle for this kind of malware, going from a software exploit that's able to escalate into the boot flash or the option ROM, hook S3, get into SMM, and then go on and infect other machines in the boot flash. And once it's in that sort of boot flash option ROM kind of space, it's completely underneath the OS. So most virus scanners aren't even looking for it and probably couldn't even see it because they have the ability to trap all of those memory references and hide from normal scanning techniques. Pretty much the only way you could see if it's in the boot flash would be to put a chip clip on the SPI flash there and read it out and hope that nothing's interfering with that. Any attempt to do it in software is going to be masked by the proof of concept. So Johanna presented a lot of ideas about things we could do to deal with the inevitability of rootkits and firmware issues, attempts to try to move it outside the system. But there are a lot of smaller steps we can take as well. Things like checking the signatures on the option ROMs or not even loading option ROMs is a really big first step. Using all of the locks that the platform provides is really key. Making sure that the BIOS is not writable to OS resident attackers, making sure that they can't hook the S3 boot script to get into SMM. Intel has added features to UEFI, like the SMM lockbox, that allow the S3 boot script to be protected from attackers. And there are tools like ChipSec and Copernicus that can help validate these configurations to make sure that the systems are being booted and run in a safe manner. Intel is also continuing some hardware attempts. Some of their newer CPUs have a feature called BootGuard. And this adds actual ROM for the first instructions the CPU executes, which is sufficient to do a cryptographic verification of the boot flash before executing any code out of it. This is great for security, but unfortunately, this locks out free software developers. So systems with BootGuard are fundamentally incompatible with Core Boot. And that's a really difficult move for software freedom, even if it does provide a good level of protection. And my plea to system vendors is that when new vulnerabilities are disclosed, that to really work with researchers to try to figure out if they're vulnerable. I write a lot of proof of concepts, and they're really difficult to get working on one machine, much less a range of machines. So sometimes vendors take the proof of concept, they run it on their system, it doesn't work, and they say, oh, we're not vulnerable. And there's really not any risk to them for doing that. So it would be great if vendors were more proactive in working with researchers on helping to port these things and find that out. The legacy code, as Corey found, there's a lot of code, dead code in EFI that may have vulnerabilities. And even if you think that your system's not running it, it might be possible with a set of inputs to get the code to jump into it. It's super important to test the full cross product of old vulnerabilities and systems. That things like Snorlax being an old vulnerability that reappeared a few years later is actually really kind of scary. That there was we learned about a really serious bug, and systems got fixed, and then new systems got produced that were still vulnerable to that old bug. That's a problem. Likewise, new vulnerabilities they don't necessarily get tested against older systems, so we don't know what machines are actually vulnerable other than the current generation of machines. And please, if you're in an opportunity to fix security vulnerabilities, don't just do it silently. Make sure that people know, these are the CVEs that are being patched against. These are the things that that are being changed, and what systems will actually be secure against. Because when we're in the dark with this, it's really dangerous. We don't know if we're going to, just because my machine's 2 years old and you've got a newer machine, it's dangerous for us to not have that certainty. So, on that, I'd love to open up for some questions. There's a lot more details about the vulnerabilities on my website. I'm also happy to take GPG emails and continue the discussion on these firmware topics.
Thank you.
I think you switched off, was it?
I think the battery's dead. To be quite honest. Okay, we'll do this without the mic for a second. Now we're gonna take.
Can you try that one?
Yes, we should be on tape. Thank you. Not for you guys, but for the people out there in the stream. So we're going to do a little question talk. And we'll do one question from the room, one question from the web, and then again a question from the room. So are there any questions out there? Yep. Mic three, please.
Yes. Have you seen actual SPI flash arrays? Commands going to your flash chips, or how is it actually managed on the background with different SPI flash chips?
Are you asking, does the OS periodically do erases of some sort?
Because to write to flash, you also have to erase flash first before you can write to it, right?
That's right. So yeah. For things like the NVRAM variables, and this, there's a related question of why does Apple leave the flash writable? And they store the non-volatile variables in the flash. So things like, what is your screen brightness? What was the last Wi-Fi network and credentials that you logged into are stored in the NVRAM. And it's stored in a log, a pin structure. So you can add items to it. And then they can set individual bits to mark to tombstone old values. And once they fill up a block, then they will do a full erase rewrite cycle. But typically, they just do append and then tombstone marking.
Okay. Do we have a question from the internet? Is there anybody out there?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
How is BootGuard related or different to the Trusted Platform module?
So the Trusted Platform module is unfortunately not, it assumes that the SPI flash is protected, that the Trusted Platform module is outside the CPU, so and it only signs, or it only generates hashes based on what the CPU has asked it to do. So if you have malware that has taken over the SPI flash, it is able to send whatever values it wants to the TPM. That the TPM can't look at memory, the TPM can't look at the state of the CPU. The TPM only hashes what's given to it. So BootGuard moves the trust inside the CPU, so it's no longer having to go to this outside device. And because BootGuard doesn't even start executing code from the flash until it verifies it, this means that a malicious attempt to modify the flash will be detected, or will be detected on the next boot. For sure. I don't remember if they have the sort of soft fail versus hard fail in the BootGuard implementation, The TPM, unfortunately, was an interesting idea, but there's probably a dozen or two dozen papers on how to defeat it and get around it in different ways.
Okay, the next question from Mike 3.
I have had my own share with reporting bugs to Apple and getting some feedback and making sure that they actually fixed it the way that I thought it should be fixed. But I see that you seem to have that in a repetitive pattern that they thought they fixed it, they didn't consult with you, and they released a fix, and then you found out, oh no, it didn't work. I would expect that this is such a sensitive area where Apple would really want to have a dialogue with you. Did that never happen, or was it miscommunication?
It's happened. On some of the bugs, there has been a good dialogue, and we've had they have sent me betas to test, and we've had back and forth. Occasionally, things have been put out before we've had a chance to do that, and sometimes sometimes the dialogue takes longer than they want to wait for the fix. Although I do have really good hopes. They've just acquired Zeno and Corey's company, Legba Core. So I'm really hoping that this means that Apple's firmware security is going to go even better than it's been in the past few years.
One more question from the net. Nope.
Do you have a tool to check the current state of the MacBook, like if it's vulnerable or not?
The difficulty with ascertaining if the system is currently vulnerable or currently infected is that a sufficiently stealthy malware can trap all attempts to read the ROM and read the state of things. So if it's been able to infect the system, it's very, very difficult to even tell if that's happened. Tools like ChipSec will attempt to tell you if the system is in a vulnerable state. And that's one way to say if you, with a clean system, you know, you can check to see if it's whether or not it looks like it's good. But if you've had a system that you think has been infected, it's very difficult to say.
Okay, is there one more question from the net? Otherwise, we're going to call this a baby.
Okay, yeah, there's one more question from the net. What platform would you recommend to avoid UEFI boot systems, and which are nearly as compatible to our normal computers?
Well, UEFI is making its way into the ARM world now, so I'm not sure if it's possible to avoid UEFI in its entirety. By itself, that's somewhat of a good thing. It is extensible. It is nice to have a lot of that functionality, but it is a huge amount of code in the trusted compute base. And as most security researchers will tell you, that is problematic. But at this point, it looks like all the hardware is going to be UEFI in the foreseeable future. I do have good hopes for things like Bunny's laptop, open source hardware laptop with entirely open source firmware, because that at least means that we're not running a bunch of proprietary binary blobs. Things like the Intel Management Engine are certainly it's we just don't know anything about what's going on inside of it and what it might be doing. So even if you have secure firmware, you've got a binary blob running that might be doing something that you don't want, and that's somewhat of a difficult situation to be in.
Okay, let's have a final hand for Tramiel.